I'm very happy now to welcome David Gelb. He's the director of the documentary film Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which opens at the CCA here in Santa Fe this Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a film about master sushi chef Jiro Ono, who's 85 years old, or was 85 when you made the film. And it's much more than that, too. It's really the portrait of an artist and master craftsman. It's about Japanese culture and so much more than that. How did you find out about this man and come to make a film about him?
Well, originally I was going to make a film about three or four of my favorite sushi chefs. And, you know, I just love sushi. I wanted to find a way to make it my job to eat the best sushi in the world and to travel around and to film it. But all the sushi chefs kept pointing me in the direction of Jiro, you know, saying that he's the true living legend of sushi, and he kind of has defined the modern kind of tasting menu for sushi. And so when I finally got to his restaurant and ate there, I realized that there was an opportunity to make a movie that's about so much more than just sushi. As you said, you know, it's a movie about hard work and about a quest for perfection, and about a father-son relationship where the son is kind of living in his father's shadow and trying to find a way to distinguish himself. So it's set around the greatest sushi in the world, but it's really about a human journey.
Very much so. I mean, this is a man, Jiro, who had little guidance in life. He had very little in the way of good parenting, basically was more or less abandoned, and yet he came to be this person and chef that he is. How did he make that journey from poor child with not much to becoming a sushi chef?
Well, Jiro was born, in the worst depression in Japanese history in the early 1900s. And he had no choice. You know, his family couldn't support him. His dad was an alcoholic, and, you know, he had a younger brother, and his mom, you know, she couldn't work, and so they just, they couldn't make ends meet, and so they sent him away from the family, and he was sent away from home, and he had to become an apprentice at a restaurant just to survive. And the kind of apprenticeships that they did back then, you know, you'd be a kid, and you would live there and work there, and that would be your whole job. That would be your everything. And he found his talent there, and he made the best out of a really tough situation. And I think that, you know, he was influenced by his father in such a way that he wanted to be the opposite of his father. And, you know, his father didn't work hard, and his father had a drinking problem. Jiro doesn't drink at all, and he works harder than anyone that I've ever met in my life. And he's a great father to his own kids. You know, even though he's very strict and he works, his sons kind of had no choice but to support him in his restaurant. You know, they have a very loving relationship, and they're just glad to be working at the side of their father, who's really a true genius and a real inspirational. He's just a true inspiration. He's a very moving figure.
It's funny, I guess, from an American sensibility to think about what it takes, or just, I hadn't really thought about it before, what it takes to be a chef who is an artist at that level. And one of the people who speaks in your film really talks about some of the qualities that go into making a first-rate chef. And I couldn't help but thinking that those are some of the attributes that go into making a great creator of any kind.
Sure. Everything that Jiro talks about in the film, about sushi and, you know, about his craft as a chef, these lessons apply to everything. And it's something that we took to heart. You know, my editor and myself, we took this to heart very sincerely when we were making the film. Listening to Jiro's speeches and editing them, it was inspiring for us too, because, you know, it seems simple. You know, sushi making seems simple. It seems like it's just fish and rice, but to do, you know, anything can be done simply, but mastering a simple thing, that takes, you know, a lifetime. And, you know, Jiro has found the perfect balance between the fish, the rice. Every single fish has a preparation that he's been cultivating for decades and decades. And so all this experience, and it really just, when you eat a single piece of sushi at his restaurant, the rice truly elevates the fish and brings so much out of it. And in filmmaking, it's the same way, because, you know, an editor can assemble any number of images in any order with a, with a soundtrack underneath it. It might look like a movie, but in order to make it resonate, it takes years of experience to and trial and error to, you know, find a way to instill meaning and emotion into those images. And it's the same thing that he does with his sushi. It applies to everything else as well, anything.
Yeah, exactly. What was it like for you to taste his sushi? I mean, it sounds like you love sushi in the first place. What was that experience like of eating his artwork, so to speak?
Well, at first, you know, I was very nervous. And Yamamoto, the food writer who serves as kind of the narrator in the movie, he describes his experience the same way. And, you know, you go in there, you know, you've heard, you know, the legend of this man, and now you're going to go into a subway station, you know, a restaurant kind of tucked into a subway station in the basement of an office building, and you're going to be served by the greatest sushi chef of all time. And so, you know, I was very nervous. I didn't want to offend him by mishandling the sushi in some way. But what you realize when you eat there, you know, he's just concerned about making the absolute best experience for the diner. And, you know, there's a very limited window in which his ingredients are at their absolute most delicious. And so when he puts a piece of sushi down, you're supposed to eat it immediately. And that's why the meal goes fast, is because all the ingredients have been, you know, all the preparations have been designed to be at their perfect deliciousness right when the customer sits down at the sushi bar. So when you eat a piece of his sushi, the first thing you'll notice is the rice. And, you know, I've never tasted rice so delicious. I didn't even know that rice could be so delicious. It's warm, and they cook it under pressure so that it's fluffy and light, but still it retains its texture, and it's in no way mushy at all. So it's fluffy and kind of al dente at the same time. And the seasoning of the rice, the rice is a little bit more tart than we may be used to in Western sushi restaurants, but this is to achieve this balance that he's creating with the fish and the soy sauce. So when you eat a piece of tuna, a sushi at Jiro's, you're just tasting the purest essence of tuna as balanced and elevated by the other ingredients in the piece of sushi. And it's the same thing with every other fish that he prepares. You're tasting the purest flavor, be it octopus or eel or even egg. His preparations are designed to bring out the purity of the flavor. And it's just incredibly moving to eat. I mean, it's an emotional experience to eat there.
I mean, and the thing that's so interesting is that to bring out the purity of the flavor is non-trivial. It's not that you cut a piece of it and serve it. The octopus has to be massaged for 45 minutes, and some things have to be marinated, and some things have to be prepared in ways without which they wouldn't have that purity of flavor that you're talking about.
Yes, and this is what Jiro spent decades cultivating. And, you know, it seems simple, you know, just fish and rice, but every single fish is a rigorous process of preparation. So if they're serving 20 different pieces of tuna, 20 different pieces of sushi, you know, that's 20 different dishes that they're, you know, creating using the best ingredients of the day. And the preparation is extremely time-consuming. You mentioned the octopus. You know, it takes them 45 minutes to massage it, to not only to tenderize it, but also to unlock the flavors of the octopus's diet, because they're getting octopus that from an area where it's eating, you know, the most delicious shellfish and life, you know, on the bottom of the ocean. So it's all about unlocking the potential of the food. And that's actually called tabegoro, is the term that's used, you know, whether they're letting the fish rest a certain amount of time, if they're marinating it, if they're massaging it, you know, whatever it is. It's all about just bringing out the best of the flavor. And it takes years of experience and trial and error to cultivate those techniques.
And it makes one think about so many other things, like for a person to find their voice and to find their purity of expression also takes years, whether their form is sushi or whether their form is poetry or, as you're talking about, filmmaking.
Absolutely. I mean, the analogy is very potent. And it really does apply to everything. And, you know, Jiro, I hope that people that watch the film are inspired to, you know, take a look at what they're doing and think to themselves, you know, could I be doing a better job? You know, is there a better way of doing this? And, you know, am I working to my fullest potential? And, you know, Jiro, he sleeps very soundly every night. You know, he has no regrets because he knows that he's trying his absolute hardest and, you know, making no compromises if he can avoid them. And, you know, I think it's a very kind of pure way to work. I mean, it's not easy, but it's incredibly rewarding.
The idea that you could, at the age of, let's say, 80, when you've gotten every prize there is to be gotten and been written up in as a 3-star restaurant and the Michelin guide and everything else, that you are still striving for improvement. It's almost foreign, I think, to American sensibilities, because it's sort of like any of us would probably say, okay, we've got a formula, let's stick with that. But that's not good enough for Jiro.
Not at all. He's 86 years old now, and he says that he's just getting the hang of making sushi, which is kind of, that's absurd to us, because how can you be more of a master? But from Jiro's perspective, there's always an opportunity the next day to do it even better. And so he's repeating the same routine every day, just looking for that one step of improvement. And, perfection is his destination, but he also knows that he'll never reach it, because as soon as he makes a piece of sushi that he feels is perfect, the very experience of having made that piece of sushi has changed him, and now he's even looking for an even higher level. And so that's kind of, his philosophy is to never stop striving for even higher levels and never to be satisfied with what you're doing. And that's how he's gotten so good. That's why he's the master. It's because he's never satisfied. He's always looking for that one step of improvement.
We're talking to director David Gelb about the film Jiro Dreams of Sushi. What you just said about this continual self-improvement and how that changes the person, I was wondering as I was watching it, I don't know too much about Japanese culture, but I was wondering how the portrait of this man speaks to a larger portrait of Japanese culture, whether it be Zen, Buddhist meditation, or anything else.
It applies to, there is a man like Jiro, or perhaps dozens of them in every craft, and this is something that's very special about Japanese culture, and it's kind of they call it the way of the shokunin, and a shokunin is a craftsman who works for the purpose of working and improving, and it's somebody who devotes their life to a single craft, be it flower arranging, pottery, painting. There's a way of the shokunin in every field, and in Japan they really specialize on a single thing. For example, in the fish market, you'll see in the film we have some great scenes where we go into the fish market and we talk to Jiro's suppliers, and he's not going to a Whole Foods where there's one guy behind the seafood counter. This is a city of craftsmen where there are maybe a dozen guys, all with individual businesses, who are all competing to make the absolute best, to source the absolute best shrimp. There's Jiro's shrimp dealer. He only deals with shrimp. He's devoted his life to specializing, and mastering this single ingredient. And it's the same with all the other ingredients that he gets. And that's kind of why they're able to reach such high levels of excellence, is because they have the patience to spend a long time in the training process for their master, and then spending their entire lives trying to improve their own craft. And I think it's one of my favorite things about Japan is how, they have this kind of patience and craftsmanship is rewarded in the society. And I think that's great, and I'd love to see more of that in the West. And I think that we are seeing a little bit more of it here.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, one of the things that was really striking and thought-provoking for me was how various different people in the film would say, we don't do this for the money. Now, you look at Japan, that's such a successful capitalist culture, and yet they weren't about anything that resembled greed. It was about this quality, detail, attention to those things, and in a funny way, that's what made them so successful, was not really caring about how much money they were going to make on this, but the better their quality was, probably the better they did.
Oh, sure. It's really interesting. A lot of them, especially the craftsmen like Jiro, they say that it's not about the money. And for a lot of people, that may not be true. Like in the case of large corporations, this is kind of a Western construct that they've adopted, where you have shareholders and you have to make a profit. It's profit above all else, and you owe that to your shareholders. But at a place like Jiro's, he has one other restaurant that his younger son has opened, and that's it. So they're only Jiro could have a sushi empire. With all this prestige, he could open restaurants all over the world, like guys like Morimoto or Nobu have done. But that's not what he's in it for. He's in it for making that perfect single bite, that perfect tasting menu, and he can only maintain the quality that he chooses to, that he's chasing, with these small kind of, you know, with these small sushi bars, just two of them, you know, with 10 seats each. You know, it's just amazing. And it's definitely not efficient to have an apprentice massaging an octopus for an hour. But he doesn't care, you know, because it's really just not about the money for him. And I think that's, you know, some of the greatest craftsmen, you know, they just care about doing the work. And they just do the work for the sake of doing good work. And I think that's just, like, very beautiful and poetic.
Indeed. Now, Jiro's sons have been trained by him. They're extraordinary chefs in their own right. One is essentially the one who will become his heir when he either passes from this world or can no longer work or whatever. And the other has his own very similar sushi restaurant. And I was watching this and thinking, here are two very different situations. One is a completely self-made man. The other is these sons who are essentially going into the family business. Do you see in the sons that same passion and quality that their father has?
Oh, I very much do see that passion in his sons. And they, you know, their lives are, I definitely see a parallel in the way that they grew up and the way Jiro did. But, you know, the main difference being that Jiro, you know, provided for them when they were children, whereas, you know, Jiro really had to, you know, work just for survival. And, but his sons, you know, Jiro always says that, you know, you don't get to choose your job, and your job chooses you. And, you know, like, for example, a lot of people that go into film school, they all want to be directors, but you kind of, through the process, you kind of find where your niche is. And I think that, you know, for Yoshikazu, Jiro's older son, you know, he described that when he was younger, he wanted to be a fighter pilot, and he wanted to be, you know, a race car driver. And, but he just kind of fell into sushi because he had to work for his father, but then he discovered his love for it through the act of doing it. And, you know, so he's accepted kind of his role as kind of the flag bearer for, you know, his father's legacy now. And, but it you know, it's a journey to him to accept that. And, you know, we cover that a bit in the film, and that's a big part of his journey.
What is the life, well, first of all, what is Jiro's life like? I mean, it's a life of incredibly hard work, but describe a day in Jiro's life, and then maybe we can also talk about what the life of an apprentice is like.
Well, Jiro is now 86 years old, and he had a heart attack when he was 70. And at that point, he stopped going to the fish market himself and transferred that responsibility to his older son, who had been following Jiro to the fish market for, you know, at least 20 years. So Jiro will, you know, he'll wake up, his wife will make him breakfast, and he'll go to the restaurant and just kind of check in on the apprentices and make sure that they're doing the preparations properly. He'll taste the food to make sure that it's up to his standard. And then, you know, he's sort of a supervisor and kind of a leader for them. Yamamoto, the food writer, describes him as kind of a conductor of a symphony because, you know, it's a team effort. And the amount of preparation that goes into making this exquisite sushi meal, you know, it's not physically possible to be done by a single person. So his apprentices, it takes 10 years to become a full sushi chef or be able to, you know, really be standing behind the bar and assisting Jiro with the preparations in front of customers. That takes 10 years. So his apprentices, they start by learning to squeeze the hot towels, you know, before the customers come in. And then they learn to prepare the fish. And then only after 10 years are they allowed to even try to make the egg sushi. And that's kind of the final level. So every day an apprentice will wake up at about 6 in the morning. They'll meet Yoshikazu, Jiro's older son, at the fish market, who will have already been there selecting the fish from each of the vendors. And then they'll be biking that back to the restaurant. And then they start the preparation. It's the same thing every day, depending on what kind of fish they get. And, you know, there's a lot of timers, very precise work in terms of marinating the fish, making sure that it's at the correct temperature for service, making the rice, which is, you know, the most important job in the restaurant probably. And then, you know, basically, you know, preparing all this stuff is an incredible amount of work. And then the restaurant opens at around 11:30. They'll do maybe two servings. You know, 10 people at the bar each serving, and then they'll take a lunch break, and they might take a nap in the restaurant even, and then just do the same thing over again for dinner, because the preparations for breakfast, the preparations for lunch, they can't just prepare for the whole day because the timing is so specific, so they have to do the preparations all over again for dinner, and that's just to meet that standard of quality. So, you know, Jiro's standards are incredibly high, and the apprentices there work incredibly hard for a very, very long time.
I couldn't help but think when, I mean, the first thing they have to do is learn to squeeze out the hot towels. It was sort of reminded me of those Zen stories of the Zen apprentice who has to sweep the floor for 5 years before he even gets to learn to meditate. Then you've got these apprentices who, I mean, if they've worked for Jiro for 10 years, they've got it made. They can probably work anywhere they want. Is that true?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, if you've been at Jiro's restaurant for 10 years, that's a, it's almost like receiving a doctorate in sushi.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a longer time than a lot of doctorate studies are in the United States. And you become a standard bearer of the restaurant. And so, you know, I just found out recently that Nakazawa, Jiro's senior apprentice below his son, recently has come to Seattle to work in a sushi restaurant there. And so, you know, he's taken his training at Jiro and the prestige associated with that, and he's starting a new life in the United States with his family at a very prestigious sushi restaurant. And, you know, I think that's kind of that's the dream of the apprentice, is to, you know, to learn from a true master and then, you know, take that skill and kind of build a, build something for their own family. And I think that's, you know, that's great.
Is the sushi chef business as much of a completely all-male sort of brotherhood as it seems to be in the film? Are there any women doing it at all?
In Japan, you know, sushi making is kind of a male business, and there's not really a good reason for that, I don't think. Japan, you know, just in general, is a little bit behind on gender equality than a lot of the Western world. And so, you know, in my interviews, I heard a lot of reasons why women can't be sushi chefs. And, you know, there were so many different reasons that, you know, you kind of realize that, you know, none of these are really true. And so it's just rare in Japan. And I think it's just part of the traditional kind of patriarchal society where the father passes his craft to the sons, and then, you know, they hope that their daughters get married. And I think that there are lots of opportunities for female sushi chefs abroad, and I hope that there are more of them in Japan, because there are fantastic female chefs in the world. I mean, some of the best are female, and you know, so I don't see why it is, but it's just kind of a fact that female sushi chefs and female chefs are kind of marginalized in Japan.
In the movie, it's mentioned that there's a month waiting list to even get in to have a meal at this restaurant. It must be even more now since the film came out.
Well, you know, the film has kind of alerted the Western world to his presence. So in Japan, he was already a celebrity. You know, there have been TV specials about him, and he's just known, you know, sort of like we know Bobby Flay and we know Wolfgang Puck and, you know, some of these big chefs here. In Japan, you know, he is known as kind of, you know, the god of sushi. But exposing him to the Western world offers them the potential of a lot more customers to come. And foreign customers were coming to the restaurant as soon as they got the 3 stars in the Michelin guide. That was sort of a beacon to foodies from around the world that, you know, this is the kind of the mecca of sushi. Like, this is kind of the apex. And after the tsunami and earthquake, you know, disaster last year, the restaurant has had trouble with business, and a lot of kind of high-end restaurants in Japan have had trouble because of the economy has been, you know, really terrible there, and people are just kind of nervous and anxious, you know, and it makes it difficult for business. So, you know, I strongly suggest that people go to Jiro and, you know, kind of support these artists, and, you know, his overhead is very high because he's getting the absolute best fish, so, you know, it's a little bit easier to get in now, and you know, so if you're going to go to Japan, have your hotel make a reservation for you, and you know, be prepared to experience the best sushi in the world. And yeah.
David Gelb is the director of the documentary film Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which opens at the CCA this Friday. I just have to ask you before we go: is it hard to eat anything else now that you've eaten the best?
Well, yeah. You know, the hardest part coming after eating the best sushi in the world and coming back to the United States is, you find it hard to find sushi restaurants that pay attention to the rice. And, you know, sushi is so much about the rice. Jiro himself says that 70% of the importance of the sushi is on the rice, because that's the constant for every single piece of fish that you're going to eat as sushi. It's all going to be on top of this rice. So the rice should be just a little warm, you know, it should be body temperature. And too many sushi restaurants kind of serve cold, kind of mushy rice, or, you know, and I just think that more attention needs to be paid on the rice. So I'll only go to sushi restaurants that have good rice now.
Very interesting. Well, thank you, David Gelb, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Arun Gupta and Michelle Fawcett. They are journalists writing about the Occupy movement for Salon.com. Arun is co-founder of The Independent and The Occupied Wall Street Journal, and Michelle is adjunct professor of media studies at NYU. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be with you again.
So you were here last November, and we had quite a nice discussion about the Occupy movement. Since then, you've regrouped and started traveling again, and you've been to big cities, small cities, towns, Alaska, Hawaii. I don't know if you were Alaska. You were in Hawaii, and you have seen this movement on the ground. Where are you coming from before this Santa Fe trip?
We just came from Tucson, Arizona. Actually, we were in Los Angeles kind of regrouping and catching up and writing articles and making films after our first tour. And then we got back on the road again. And we are doing a kind of Occupy Tour 2.0, if you want to call it that, and seeing where the Occupy movement stands. It's a very different tour than the first tour because we're kind of in the post-encampment phase. So in tour number one, when we went around in the fall, there were encampments all across the country, and it was fairly easy to find people and to sort of get a quick overview of what each occupation was doing. And this trip's a little bit different. Because Occupy is not in the mainstream media as much, I think a lot of the general public probably thinks the Occupy movement is completely dead. But what we're finding already, and we've only been out, 10 days now in the second tour, which is probably going to last two and a half months, is that, in fact, it is still very much alive, but just in a different kind of way. And it's a way that's harder to find, because they're not as visible, they're not standing on a street corner, but they're very much spreading out into the community and kind of regrouping, really.
So what does it look like? Give us some examples.
Well, now that the encampments are no longer there, it's two sides of a coin. You know, there are good parts and there are parts that don't appear so good. In terms of you, on the one hand, you have really good movements around foreclosure defense, people who are actively defending by risking arrest, homeowners who are in foreclosure, keeping them from being evicted. Foreclosure activists are also disrupting auctions of foreclosed properties somewhat successfully, at least delaying them. They're getting banks to renegotiate these loans, or to recognize that there's a lot of there's fraudulent activity with various foreclosure cases by putting pressure on them. There's big campaigns against the banks. There's one called F the Banks, which is targeting Bank of America specifically. And what activists are trying to do there is actually take down Bank of America. Bank of America, according to the activists, is still receiving significant bailout funds. They're in trouble through all sorts of bad loans still on their books. And so what their strategy is to kind of help push Bank of America's on the brink. So in their analysis, well, if they can give it a little push over the brink and the government has to intervene, this time instead of a bailout, what they want to do is push for a dismantling of a Bank of America. There's a lot of tremendous organizing going on, cross-organizing with labor. There'll be a lot of, probably hundreds, there'll be hundreds if not thousands of different protests on May Day.
In terms of Bank of America, a lot of people withdrew their money from Bank of America and put it in credit unions and other kinds of banks because of the Occupy movement organizing. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is true. I mean, I was just talking to folks in Austin who work with their bank and housing working group, and they say they have recorded well over $1 million in money that's been moved from the big banks to local financial institutions. And Austin, Texas has very much a kind of buy local, local business philosophy there. It very much permeates the community there. And this is actually, it's a good example of, you know, the good and the bad part of, you know, the problematic parts of the Occupy movement. So this was a big campaign that actually started last November. There was a November 5th Move Your Money Day, millions of dollars successfully moved. Both Austin, Texas, and Kentucky are actually petitioning their representative government, so Austin city government and the Kentucky state government, to move all the funds that they have from the big Wall Street banks into community financial institutions. In the case of Kentucky, they estimate it's something like $8 to $12 billion that is being held. In Austin, it's not like that level, but the amount of transactions that goes through it is in the many hundreds of millions of dollars, because there's a very big public sector payroll in Austin, Texas. At the same time, you know, they're economists like Doug Henwood. He's a very noted left economist who worked on Wall Street. And when the Move Your Money campaign was going on, he was like, look, you know, these community financial institutions, a lot of them were actually heavily implicated in the subprime mortgage crisis. You know, so don't fool yourself thinking that this is somehow a positive. And what I say is that this is what we can call a perceptual victory. And if this movement is going to sustain itself and grow, it needs victories. And so the Move Your Money campaign, I think, has been a perception of a victory. And that's important in the medium term. But in the long term, you need actual victories.
What kind of actual victories is the movement looking for?
I think they're looking wherever they can get it. The one place I don't think that they're specifically pouring a lot of energy into is legislation and policy. They will support specific campaigns. So in Ohio, there was a lot of the Occupy movements there supported the campaign to repeal the laws that would have essentially eliminated the public sector union's ability to collectively bargain.
Right.
And that was an overreach, frankly, because the governor also included the firefighters and policemen in it. And the unions also there realized this was do or die. And it's clear that Occupy Wall Street did have a real effect. That in terms of changing people's consciousness about the 1% attacking the 99%, the greed, and the repeal was by a very wide margin. It was like 62 to 37%. But AFSCME poured something like $35 million into the repeal campaign, you know, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, because if this law stood, they would have been wiped out in Ohio.
Right.
They had to throw everything they had. And this is actually part of the right strategy, is to throw so much anti-union legislation and policy, one to try and destroy the unions, but at minimum they want to at least bankrupt them.
When you say the right strategy, you mean the right wing, not the correct strategy.
Right, the right wing strategy, the Republican, the Tea Party, you know, the Alec, Koch brother, you know, that many-headed beast.
So let's talk a little bit more about your travel. So you're going from town to town. Okay, it's just turning to spring now. What are you seeing? What are you seeing in Laramie and Boise and the Bay Area and all these places that you've been?
Well, we're actually just starting Occupy 2.0 tour, and we left Los Angeles about 10 days ago, and we're on the road now. We went to Tucson.
But you went to these places, because before we started, you were saying you'd been to all these other places, but that was the last
That was the last tour.
So
right.
That was when they were still encampments.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So now we're launching on this second tour to find out what happened, right, to sort of follow up on the story, because we know through, you know, keeping in touch with all the contacts we made, and we spoke to hundreds of occupiers all across the country, that the movement is still alive, just in different kinds of ways. So You know, there's a challenge in trying to find people, first and foremost. We found
Don't they all have websites?
They do have websites, but it's actually very problematic. I mean, we've heard many stories of websites being hijacked by certain individuals, that certain individuals took over websites in the beginning, that they took the URL and didn't allow that URL to be used by the Occupy. So there's a lot of confusion.
Meaning people who were anti-Occupy?
Well, it's not exactly clear. I mean, I think it's either people who, you know, who were just going to sit on the website and didn't make much use of it. There's actual cases of what we're seeing now, actually, and something we're going to look into as we go around the country, is unfortunately, or maybe not unfortunately, I shouldn't say that. I mean, we have to see how this really works itself out. But we're seeing some splitting within the Occupies, where the Occupies are splitting into two very distinct groups in some of these cities.
So like, what do those two groups look like?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. In Orange County, there was a split between what was pretty much presented to us as an age and political ideological split. So there was an older liberal contingent that split off from a younger, what was called anarchist contingent. And the older liberal contingent decided that they no longer wanted to occupy with the younger contingent because there was a lot of difficulty in the camp, a lot of things they didn't really agree with. And so they're organizing really out of their own homes. And they all along called themselves what's known as home-based occupiers. They were people who weren't camping out on a daily basis, so it wasn't too big of a leap for them to pull back and to work with the allies that they found in the movement and to meet in cafes and to have much more sort of campaign-based actions, that type of organizing is going on in that part of the community. Meanwhile, there's another contingent that moved to Fullerton in Orange County and is also called Occupy Fullerton or Occupy Orange County, and they're continuing a very visible and pretty substantial camp there. So that's one split that we've been seeing. And there's some of the kind of age-old left splits, right? There's a split between liberals and people who are further left on the spectrum, right? Those who might be anarchists or part of other affiliations. There's also a split between race and class that we're seeing. And that also, of course, is an age-old split. And we're seeing it here in Albuquerque, that there is two Occupy groups here in Albuquerque. There's an Unoccupy and an Occupy.
An Unoccupy?
Yes.
What's that?
Unoccupy voted very early on by consensus to call itself Unoccupy in full recognition that this land is already occupied and it is indigenous land that has been occupied by colonizers. And so very early on, occupiers wanted to address this very problematic word of occupy, that it isn't a positive word, and it isn't a positive word for many people around the world who have been occupied and taken over and oppressed by others. So there was a vote to call it Unoccupy. They wanted to get rid of the word Occupy entirely because it is an offensive word, but recognizing that Occupy Wall Street is in a way trying to take back that word, is trying to reoccupy the commons or you know, other public spaces.
And it's known. So it's affiliated
yes.
with that.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And there's also very much, and I saw this in Hawaii, Occupy Honolulu is actually called Deoccupy Honolulu. So it was a linguistic way of dealing with a problem in the movement, to recognize, yes, we're in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street movement that, of course, is against economic injustice, broadly speaking. But at the same time, we have to recognize that there's been forms of oppression based on race and identity, and that occupation is an offensive word. So the way to resolve that was to put the word together and just say unoccupy or deoccupy.
So what are demographically, what are the two different groups in Albuquerque look like?
Well, we've only met with one group so far,
oh, okay.
and we were only able to see part of that group. So I would hesitate to say exactly what that group looks like. But, Occupy in general, it's difficult to say because there's occupiers that are involved in different levels. There's the folks who come out for meetings, there's the folks who talk to the press, and there's a great number of people who just come to other events and other meetings. It's kind of been spread out a little bit. But
do you expect a resurgence now that the weather's getting nice all over the country?
Well, there has been a resurgence already. I think one of the most perceptive organizers out there made a very good comment to me, David Solnit in the Bay Area, brother of the noted author Rebecca Solnit. He's like, you know, during the first phase, the metrics for success were the occupations, how many numbers were coming out, and whether those two phenomena were being amplified through the media owned by the 1%. And he says we need we need a better yardstick. You know, and the problem is that affected people, even people within the movement, even very sophisticated people within the movement, affected the perception of whether the movement was succeeding or not. So I was in New York a few weeks ago, and when I was there, it just so happened. And I mean, there was like significant protests every single day for over a week. It just so happened to intersect with the Trayvon Martin. The outrage over Trayvon Martin. And that is actually, that's another kind of split very similar to the Unoccupy split. It isn't a formal split, but it's a fracture, let's call it. Because we've heard this at a lot of movements where there is a segment, and, you know, frankly, it's kind of white middle class that isn't willing to, at least initially, accept that police profiling and the prison industrial system is an issue of economic inequality. You know, it's, and I think, you know, someone today said, you know, Occupy should not be about reconstructing the middle class. And I think that's a little bit of a caricature of it, but that is also, at the same time, there's a bit of a truth to that, that I think some of the more naive people think that's what it's supposed to be about. And there's plenty of forces who want to co-opt it that way, like Van Jones,
right.
A reprehensible individual.
With some lovely qualities, too. I mean, it's, you know, these things,
He's really cynical in the way that he has glommed onto the Occupy movement, and he has... you know, he's not ashamed of being called a leader or posing himself as a leader when he had nothing to do with it. There's a lot of cynical co-optation going on where they're trying to shunt it into the Democratic Party, which is the graveyard of social movements. I mean, it's one thing to try and work with the Occupy movement. It's another thing to try and take the language and ideas of the Occupy movement and use it to strengthen a party that is as much or if not more of a problem than the Republican Party, because everyone knows the Republican Party is the party of the rich. The problem in this country is people still somehow believe this lie that the Democratic Party is the party of the working people, when Obama has done nothing but been the best friend of the 1% and the war machine for the last 3 years. So in any way, that's getting off topic.
We're talking to Arun Gupta and Michelle Fawcett about the Occupy movement. I mean, the thing that I think is really important to talk about, okay, there are these splits, and they are understandable, and we've seen them before in movement after movement going back decades, if not centuries, and they're part of the history of our country. What is the common theme? Is there a common goal or a common purpose or heart in the Occupy movement that you've seen?
I think there is, and I think that when we talk about splits, it isn't necessarily an entirely negative thing. I mean, we're talking about tensions that have been within the left, like you said, for many years. What the Occupy movement does, and I think it, you know, may even be, I mean, I can't speak for the goals of the Occupy movement, right? This is what everybody says around the country, all of the occupiers, that, you know, but I think it's fair to say that Occupy is an opportunity to talk about these splits and to talk about whether or not there needs to be these kinds of splits. Is there a common goal? You know, can we find a way in which class very much intersects with race and race very much with class? These are, you know, seemingly inextricably tied in the system that we live in right now. Does there need to be a split, or does there need to be a way in which we can come back to it and see what do we have in common? And I think that's what Occupy has done all along. Not that we're able to say immediately, you know, in soundbite form, 1, 2, 3, what we have in common, but that we're trying to find what we have in common. We believe that there's something wrong with the system. Some people think it's the system of capitalism itself that is inherently flawed and is always going to produce crisis and inequality. Other people think it's a matter of reform. That would be another split that we just talked about. But at the base is a belief that there is something wrong with the system, that it is producing a tremendous amount of inequality. And those who are coming from, you know, race sort of studies are trying to point out that this affects people of color disproportionately. So how can we talk about these issues of a profound inequality, which is very complicated, intersects with a lot of different issues, I think that's what Occupy is grappling with right now, and I think that's why we're seeing some fractures and some tensions and some splitting. But ultimately, we're trying to come back to, initially when Occupy first started, there was very much a belief that we're all on the same page. Suddenly, the 99% is a cohesive unit. We all have the same problem. The American dream is dead. There's no more opportunity. We've lost hope. There is no real democracy. We're trying to come back to a sense of real democracy, real control over our lives, and a sense of fairness and justice and equality. And how do we get there? So,
is there a focus at all on the environment in the Occupy movement?
Yeah, very, very much so. It especially tends to be a lot around energy issues. And a lot of individual Occupy movements are taking up the issue of hydrofracking because that's going on very destructive in their region. You know, someplace like West Virginia, it's mountaintop removal, hydrofracking, and what they call Chemical Alley, kind of the industrial corridor of chemical manufacturers. Of course, in the Gulf region, it's BP and the oil spill. And I think there's also some movement around climate justice activism. 350.org, Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein's group has gotten involved. Definitely working with the Occupy movement. I want to go back to the question you just posed about, is there a common theme? I think there is a good way to look at a common theme. It's a democracy movement. But what's different about the Occupy movement, it is made put on the table, is that you cannot have political democracy without economic democracy. And that is kind of the lie that we've been told all our lives, and I think also it's a problem of a lot of political organizing that I think, you know, the liberal groups, you know, they may have a lot of well-meaning people, but you're not going to change anything through electoral politics, you know. And there was, like, again, you know, in back in the fall, there was an attempt to glom on by Van Jones, we're going to run 2,099% candidates. You know, the only way you're going to have democracy is by having economic democracy, which means that people have control over the economic decision-making, over the resources. And of course, that's big, difficult, and messy. But if we want to live in a society that really does allow for everyone to express themselves, to be themselves, to take care of each other, then we have to have economic and political democracy both.
And you don't think that economic democracy can be achieved, at least partly, through political means?
Well, there's an interrelation between the two. That's what it's saying. You know, when it says, you know, we are the 99%, and it's saying there's a 1%, or, you know, stop corporate personhood, what it's saying is that there's a very small segment of the population and an economic form, the corporation, that has been able to grab all this economic power, and with it, they use that economic power to leverage political power, and then leverage political power to increase their economic power, to then increase their political power back and forth. So it's this, you know, dialectical, this intertwined relationship. And that's culminated in Citizens United, where the Supreme Court endorsed the outright buying of the political system. We all know we had legalized bribery for decades, but at least there was some sort of restrictions on it. Now the Supreme Court says no restrictions, you know, because money is speech.
Much more to talk about, but unfortunately it's time to go. I'm so sorry. You come back to Santa Fe when you've finished there. Do you think you'll come back?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Good.
Might not be till next year, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, we hope to get continuing reports from you, and people can read your reports at salon.com.
Yeah, and we write for many other publications. Nation, Progressive, In These Times, Truth Out, Alternate, Guardian. So, but everything is at OccupyUSAToday.com.
OccupyUSAToday.com. Arun Gupta and Michelle Fawcett, journalists, co-founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal. Michelle, adjunct professor of media studies at NYU, although not right now, because they are traveling cross-country looking at the Occupy movement. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.